So I'm Tom Talpe with Microsoft. I gave a presentation last year here, so perhaps I'm known to some of you. But just by way of reintroduction, I've been at Microsoft for about 2 years. I'm actually an open source developer. I have some code in the Linux kernel, contributed heavily to NFS. I'm also very active in standards organizations such as ITF, which are really open source at their heart. But I want to talk about a slightly different spin on a standards process that I've been doing at Microsoft. When I joined Microsoft, among the projects that I was, among the many reasons I joined was this project. And so I'm very happy to talk about it here in more detail. I'm going to discuss the file sharing document set, which is the section that I personally am responsible for, and my team maintains and develops the technology behind. But really what I want to talk about is managing change in the doc set and then understanding and using the documents, because these are really extraordinarily useful documents, and it's a very special thing that Microsoft has published them. You know, we were required to do it by a number of well-publicized court actions. But, you know, that said, there's a good reason for us to do this. And we're totally committed to doing it. And we've produced what I think is some tremendous value in it. And the Samba community is one of the chief beneficiaries of this value. And so I just want to kind of give you some insight into where to find the value and how to use the value. And then just a quick look in the future. So first of all, the Microsoft Open Specifications. Everything comes down from this guy up here, protocols. The documentation library, this is just a screenshot of the web page. The documentation library is right there hiding under that button. And once you get into it, you'll find Windows protocols and these two particular programs, MCPP and WSPP. These are the two protocols. This one is the U.S.-based process, and this one is the EU-based process. They have slightly different scope. One of them, the Windows communications, is client-to-server communications, or in general, things emitted by the client. And the Windows Server protocols, WSPI, is the server-to-server protocols only. So they're slightly different. There are some protocols that are in one that are not in the other. Mostly the documents that are common are the same document, but every once in a while there's some differences. And the other interesting thing you might want to look at is the general programs up here in the middle. There's actually a new program coming online called MIP, the Microsoft Interoperability Protocols Program or something like that. It is intended over time to merge these two different protocol programs. And there's a set of documents in MIP right now it's basically a project getting started. Over time, you'll see these documents will be pulled up into MIP. The advantage there, there'll be a single program, single template, single source of information. So, the SMB document family. This is what I work on, what I am responsible for, all these documents, actually, and what my team develops. So I've tried to classify them a little bit and to give you a picture of how big they are, just so you know how big the program actually is. Up here at the top, this larger block is the core SMB protocol set. SIFS, SMB, and SMB2 are the main protocols that we know and love. There are some protocols that go very closely with them. DFSC, the Distributed File System Namespace Referral, is actually invoked by these guys. And FSCC and FSA are the file system local structures that are carried by the protocol. FSA is a recent addition, and I'll talk about it in a little bit of detail. It describes the actual algorithmic behavior of the file system, in particular NTFS. And over here on the right are the size. I colored SIFS in red as our largest document, 784 pages. SMB is a puny little guy underneath it. It's basically an extension to SIFS, which is why it's so much smaller. SMB2. But there are about 1,765 pages in the SMB2 protocol set. As we move down, there are support protocols that work with SMB. They're SMB related. Server service and workstation service are basically RPC protocols which administer the clients and servers. Browse and Browse A are discovery protocols, and FSSO is an overview. This doesn't actually describe a protocol, but it describes the interaction between protocols. They number about 650 pages. Mail and WRAP are effectively old and obsolete. They're carried only by the legacy protocols and are used only by legacy applications. And at the bottom are a number of other related protocols in distributed file system management as well as file replication. I'm not going to talk about these, but they're interesting to the talk. So it's a total in my area of about 3,341 pages. That's about 10% of the entire Microsoft corpus, maybe a little less, maybe about 8%. Very substantial amount of content, though. So the document relationships. Here at the top level, SIFS describes what was originally known as the Common Internet File System Protocol. There was an internet draft based back in the mid-90s, and SIFS was written by Chris Hertel and his team. It is the legacy version of server message block protocols. It ends at Windows NT. SMB picks up where SIFS left off, and as an extension to SIFS, it covers all the way to present-day Windows. SMB adds things like enhanced security to SIFS. SMB 2, of course, the new version, began in Windows Vista. The support began in Windows Vista, and it covers to today. DFSC, the namespace referral protocol, pretty much only resolves DFS paths. It's called by the SMB family when a DFS path is encountered. FSCC and FSA, as I mentioned, are the control codes and the algorithms. All three are invoked by the three protocols on the earlier page. And then also server service and workstation service. Server service is management and common state. That common state is important. I'm going to mention that more in more detail for both server and client. Workstation service is a shared document. Only about one-third of it relates to file service. But, for instance, the net use and things like that, RPCs are down in here. And browse and browse A that allow browsing the network over net BIOS namespace. And I already mentioned these. So that's the background. Now let's talk about change. The 3,341 pages, how do they get there and where are they going? The past year has seen a lot of change. I've been with Microsoft and working on this project for 2 years. Year one was nothing compared to last year. Last year was the beginning of the end of the court regulatory process. And there has been a lot of change as a result of that. The technical committee is the court-appointed committee, which is effectively, I guess the nice way to put it is they're a set of professional reviewers, professional document reviewers. Their charter was to study and in effect, correct any issues that were discovered in the formal documents across the entire doc set. The SMB family, in part because of its complexity, in part because of its wide adoption as an interoperability standard, got special attention, shall we say. So we got a lot of bugs as a result of this. Some of them good, some of them bad. But that was only some of what we got. There's a formal protocol and document test process within Microsoft. This has been covered by a bunch of people. I'm not going to talk about it. But there is actually each normative statement in the document is tested. There, every time you say must or should, there's a test that's coded to see that Windows does what the document said it does. At a very fine detail, we take netmon traces, we analyze every behavior of the document, and verify that it's present in the product. And also very active plugfests and licensee feedback. The plugfests are in part hosted by Microsoft and in part public, like the SNEA Storage Developers Conference co-hosts the SIFS plugfest once a year. And licensee feedback, Samba's a licensee. So the bugs that you find come back to me and I fix them. And finally, internal review. There's a whole lot of process internally to review these documents, maintain them, keep them up to the template, et cetera. So let's focus on one element of change in MS-SIFS. MS-SIFS is, by a lot, our largest document in file sharing. It's about half, again, as large as our second largest and at least twice as large as everything else, 784 pages as it sits today. So it came to exist just less than 2 years ago, right, September 2009. Thank you, Chris Hertel. Chris was the primary author of the original version of MS-SIFS. And it's undergone, not surprisingly, a lot of change as a new document. By April 2010, a year ago, it was 763 pages. And then over this past year, I just thought it would be useful to characterize what actually happened to this document. If you haven't looked at it lately, this is basically my way of encouraging you to look at it. It's grown to 784 pages, so about 20 more pages. That's not too much. But 706 issues, one issue per page, two issues per day, right, for a year. Very steady. 2,660 changes in total were queued to the document. That is, sort of elements of change to the document. And 5,443 revisions were made in the body to actually address these changes. 2,801 insertions, deletions, and moves. So, I mean, a tremendous number of changes to the document have occurred in a year. This is good and bad, right? As a new document, it needs to adapt, right? It's been tested, it's been reviewed, it's been commented on. But it's hard to track that change. So how do you tell? Well, to be honest, it's an imperfect process right now. We are required by the court to publish these documents. Therefore, we don't get to publish old versions of the documents. We are required to constantly fix the documents. Someday that may change, but for today, they are living documents. They're republished regularly. Today, it's up to about once a month. There can be up to about one new document, one new version of each document each month. They're stamped in section one of the document with a date and a revision number. Nobody ever looks at the revision number, but there is a number up there at the top. And the date is at the top and again at the bottom of each page. Section seven is a change log, and that's pretty interesting because it's marked with a tracking number, TDI, technical document issue. Not necessarily a bug, but some issue with the document has a tracking number. TDIs can come from the technical committee, from a licensee, from a test failure, anything. But if there is a tracking number, it gets one. Editorials don't usually have a TDI. But the problem is the changelog resets with each release. Those 706 changes, you actually have to go back and look at each one of these revisions to get the full list. Someday, I hope we can change this process. But for today, you pretty much want to use the latest. And determining what's different might require a little bit of effort. The information is available, so if there's a question, feel free to ask through the regular channels. So here's an example. I just ripped these out of MS-SIFs from the top of the page. So you can see that it starts in September 09 when it was first released, and it was updated a dozen times, roughly, until we got to 13.0 on March 25th. Couple months ago. There's a change that's just about to come out. I was kind of surprised it wasn't out already. But within a day or two, I expect a new version of the 14.0 to appear. And the funny thing is that all the revisions are major and all the comments are significant updates. Right. And I guess that's not surprising. Like I said, it's a new document. But that's different for other ones, for other documents. And this will settle down over time. And then over here on the right is Section 7, and this is just the beginning of a long list of changes. But you'll see that there's a TDI number right there. There's a description of what happened. There's a major minor flag, and there's a little note. These types are cataloged at the beginning of Section 7, so they're like seven or eight different classifications of these things. So this is kind of your friend if you've seen the document and you wonder what changed. The only issue is that your friend can, you can fail to call your friend for a month and you lose a big chunk of the changed log. So it can get a little tricky. But these are very handy when the time comes. All right, normative statements. This is something I've been wanting to describe, so I hope this is interesting to you. Shouting. Normative documents shout. They have capital letters, as RFC 2119 defines, and some of them are very important. Anyway, this little note is at the head of each of our documents. It says, what you think is a fairly generic statement that most people are familiar with, having read ITF documents. It's true. It's absolutely true. But note, it's true for Windows. These statements are normative to Windows. We are required by the process to document the behavior of Windows. Therefore, when we say must, we mean Windows must do it. We might be giving a suggestion to other people who want to implement an interoperable protocol, but we are required, like it or not, to only state what's true of Windows. Okay? So the protocol template requires this language for compliance. I have no choice in my choice of words here. So, implications of shouting. The statements are not necessarily written to constrain or define the behavior of other implementations. But to match Windows, they're necessary. If you want to do exactly what Windows does, I recommend you follow the letter of the normative statements in these documents. Protocol implementers, however, need to think through the implications. There are lots of reasons that you might not want to do exactly what Windows does. And also note, you won't find any other RFC 2119 terms in the document. There's a bunch of other terms defined in 2119, recommended, optional, etc. You won't find them. We can't use them. We're not allowed. So here's some detail. Shouting simplified. Here's what we mean. Must. Windows always does it. Simple, flat statement. Must not. You don't see it too often, but what we mean is Windows never does it. Simple, flat statement. Should. Okay, now things get interesting. Should means Windows does it, except we're noted. There's always a note after should, a little angle bracket with a number. I'll show you an example. And that note is very important because it tells you the exceptions when Windows doesn't do it. But normally Windows does it, so it's probably a good idea to listen to should, right? May. Now, you might think may is giving you advice. It is, but not the advice you probably think. May means Windows doesn't do it. Doesn't do it. The protocol might allow it, but Windows doesn't do it. Except as noted, just like should. And should not kind of falls in the same case. May, the difference between may and should not are very, very, very subtle. I don't recommend trying to figure it out. It'll drive you crazy. But these basically mean we don't do it. Okay? This is the one that surprises everybody, may. Because in an ITF document, may means the opposite. Yeah?
Does it hold true for the other MSDN documentation?
Hold true for the other MSDN documents? MSDN, no. MSDN is not does not follow this template. It is true developer documentation. It means what it says. But MSDN won't use capital letters, may. Or if it does, it's by accident. Yeah, this is specific normative language with a specific meaning as defined in RFC 2119. I'm just telling you what that actually means based on the context. I apologize for this, but I'm required. There's one more shouting, and that's the shouting that we don't make. What if we don't say something? If we didn't qualify with a behavior note and just said Windows may X, Windows may, you know, send such a message. That's actually invalid by template because it's a non-testable assertion, right? How can we test that Windows doesn't do it? What can we do to test that Windows doesn't do it, right? That's what my testing people will ask me. And I'll say, well, it doesn't do it. And they say, well, then it's non-testable. Take that statement out of the document. So I have to qualify it or I have to not make the statement at all. This is really annoying. But so it goes. So I could say must not. They would kind of accept that, but then I need a reason. So often it winds up being removed. Occasionally, documents give informative advice with can, small letter can. That's just one way of doing it. So sometimes we say might, but might editors fix might to may, and then somebody says, why isn't this capital letter may? And then we take that statement out. And, you know, it's just insane, the process that these things go through. But we will often say can. And if we do say may and we don't qualify it, it's probably a mistake and it should probably be can instead. Proceed with care, okay? Anytime you see something, you say, wait a minute, why isn't it talking about this? It's probably because Windows doesn't do it, is the bottom line. And it can't be added to the document because Windows doesn't do it. So it gets very confusing because of the requirements of the template. Someday I hope to actually fix this problem. But first, we have to change some things. So, should you not do it? Generally, yes. If it says should, if it says must, even if it says may, you probably ought to do what the document says. And the reason to do it is that that's what Windows does, right? We testably write this code, this English language code, and we make sure it's right. But occasionally, you may want to ignore this behavior. You may want to violate a must, for instance, if it's not supported by your system, okay? It might be supported by Windows, but might not be supported by another system. If you really, really, really well understand the reason, you know, sure, leave it out. If you're avoiding a bug, if Windows has a bug and Windows does it, guess what I have to say? You must do it, right? Because it's what Windows does. But it's a bug. You know, I wish it wasn't there, but I can't go back in time and fix Windows. So sometimes I have to say must. Go back in time and fix old versions of Windows. Obviously, I can fix current versions of Windows. It's very, very hard to generalize this fully. But think it through, and it'll usually be fairly clear. Just must in our document means something slightly different from what IETF must would mean because of that Windows context. So bear that in mind when you read these. Okay, good sense. Just a couple of examples. I just stole a piece of text out of MS SIFS because it was neat. It used must, should, may, and must a bunch of times. I tried to find one that had should not in there too, but I couldn't find a hunk of text. You definitely ought to implement the musts, all right? This is basically talking about share level access control. You must perform anonymous authentication. Okay, Windows won't. This is the client section 3.2, connecting to a tree, making a tree connect. The client must do this because Windows will reject it otherwise. So you really must do it that way if you're going to do share level access control. Of course, nobody actually does that. But so then, if the connection is already established, it should be reused. Okay, that says Windows reuses connections, right? If it's already talking to a server, it's going to use that same connection to do a new tree connect. You probably ought to do that, but you might have a reason not to. And then you read further, and you see a may. Alternatively, the client may use the deprecated smb.com tree connect request. Now, you notice there's no qualifier on here. That's actually a bug from Chris Hertel. He was being helpful by saying can, but it says may, okay? This may means don't do it. This may means it's deprecated. It's a request that you really don't want to issue. You're going to be the only kid on the block issuing this thing. You probably don't want to get picked on. You know, I'm being flip. But in general, if you see the may, don't do it. So I recommend implement the must. Strongly consider implementing the shoulds because you'll behave like Windows does. And don't implement the may unless you really, really mean to. Think it through before you implement a may. Nonsense. The opposite of good sense. So this nonsense is actually an interesting piece of nonsense, and I just thought I'd share. The technical committee found this bug. They said, you don't document the NetRU's APIs. And our response to that was, they're local only, right? You're basically mounting a share. You don't want to remote the mounting of a share, right? You don't want the client to tell the server to mount another share, right? You wouldn't be able to use it. Well, it turns out Windows has a bug. Windows actually processes this RPC on the server, if you can believe it, and mounts a share on behalf of that user. It doesn't make it available to anybody at all, but there it is, hanging on the server, ready for that user to use, should he happen to be magically appear local. Well, so we have to implement text for this, because this is Windows behavior. If you send Windows this RPC, you can't do it from Windows, but you can code one up by hand. We had to code one up by hand. It'll answer it, and it'll succeed. So here's what we wound up saying. We went to all this trouble to document NetRU's ad, and it's three buddies, right? Using them and used whatever. So there's about, you know, a page and a half of text hiding here. So we say workstation servers should not allow this method to be invoked remotely. which I thought was a very funny thing for a protocol document to say, and should return error call not implemented. And what we're doing is, you know, oops, we have a bug, and guess what? We're going to fix this in the future. So this is our little escape clause. In effect, we added this behavior note that says, even though Windows servers expose it, it is intended to be called only by a process on the local machine. Don't do it. Please don't. Please don't implement it. Okay? I had to do it. I was required to do it. You know, technically, we should have said must implement right here. We shouldn't have said should not allow this thing. We should have said workstation servers must implement this. And should return that no version of Windows does this. Right? That would have been just as crazy. Some examples of change. I just want to ground some examples in what we've done to the document on a structural level. Shared state is kind of an interesting topic, I think. Originally, or formally, the SMB documents had this thing called a shared state abstract model. The abstract model is this formal model that the template requires us to use. It's kind of like your global variables. Basically, you define, you know, global lists, global state, things like that, in something called the abstract state of the document. It's up in section 3.1. And that abstract state is then acted on by the methods, the processing methods in the document. If you create that abstract state as a shared state, it can be shared across other protocols. And what we did was we had this guy called ServeS, the server service, that does things like manipulate shares, tree connects, sessions, connections, transports, things like that. Things that configure servers and clients, which are common across all the SMB protocols and managed by this third-party helper called ServeS. Okay, so we define this thing called a shared state in which each protocol was responsible for its own objects. SIFS had its own sessions, SMB had its own sessions, SMB2 had its own sessions. And then the objects were shared with ServeS to be managed and controlled and fetch statistics. It turned out to be completely unmanageable. You can think of this as code. You basically write a great big global heap, right, and everybody points at it, and everybody has to lock it, and everybody has to notice when it changes, and blah, blah, blah. It just drives you crazy. It didn't consistently cover all three protocols. They all had different behaviors. They all supported different animals, like, you know, SIFS supported NetBIOS, ancient NetBUI, for instance, and SMB and SMB2 don't. So, well, I guess SMB does. It violates locality and ownership, so you make a change in one document, you suddenly broke the other document. You know, this is just code. It's in English, I know, but it's code. It's abstract code. And the documents, as a result, were buggy as heck. They were just completely unmanageable. So after dealing with our 473rd bug on this type of thing, we threw it away. But this is what it used to look like. There were three protocols, and each protocol had its own set of shared state. It had a share list, a transport list, blah, blah, blah. And it had these, I've just snapped five of the more important ones. And then MS ServeS literally reached into these lists and peeked at them and managed them. Would try to close a connection, for instance. You can say, you know, close somebody's connection. And these management APIs came in from the side to tell ServeS what to do. And the document wound up looking like this. It looked really simple and really clean. It said, SMB2, global structures. The server implements the following, a global session table, a list of all the active sessions indexed by the ID. Okay. And then authenticate a new session, right? When you create a new session, you allocate the thing, you insert it in the table, and you assign it a unique ID. Simple, right? ServeS. Okay, the server must, this server is the ServeS server. It has a session list, but it's shared with all these other guys, right, as described in SMB and SMB2. And then when you enumerate it, you just kind of reach out, you know, into that share list because it's, you know, you just imported it from this external module. Well, this was a real pain. So we got rid of it. We changed to this managed state object model. It has an abstract common registry of objects, where objects are allocated and owned by the protocols. And it's almost as simple as the session is created by the SIFS protocol, and it gets an ID by registering the session with ServeS. I'll show you a quick diagram in a minute. Identifiers are assigned and registered by ServeS, not by SIFS, SMB, and SMB2. right? So the identifier in serve S is basically, well, the address of the object is a perfectly good identifier. We try to state this more abstractly. It inserts it into its own list and returns that ID. So everything happens by ID. Instead of reaching into the list, it passes an ID. And so the new managed state looks basically like well-structured code, right? You basically have IDs over here with the actual objects being owned by the ones that created it. So serve S is managing IDs with registrations coming in and callbacks coming back out. You know, enumerate, or rather, return me the statistics of ID number 12345, session number 12345, or tear down session 12345, that kind of thing. So it's the ownership is properly held by the protocols, and the indexing and management is properly held by serve S. So this looks like a big, huge change. It was really just sort of a refactoring of our abstraction. And it turned out to be a great simplifier for the document and for the maintenance of the document. But I guess I want to stress that you don't have to implement code this way, right? This is an abstract description of how the code behaves. However, when you look at the document, you may be surprised, especially if you're familiar with the way the document used to look, and you come and look at it again today. So, this is the actual code in the document for the managed state. So here, where I just picked on SMB2 and the session, the global session table is nothing but a list of the active sessions indexed by the ID. When you authenticate a new session, it allocates the session, inserts it into the local global session table, and gets the session a global session ID by registering it with serve S, this 3162 call, right? That's basically a subroutine in MS serve S. And that assigns this global ID. And then over here in serve S, this is basically the other side of it. Like here's 3162 that we called there. The SIFS or SMB server requests registration and provides no parameters. It just says, I need a new session ID, right? And then you basically assign it. It inserts a new session, which is nothing but the ID, into the session list, right? I think I showed that ID happening over here. No, it doesn't matter. And returns the value. And there's a similar deregistration. And then at the bottom, there's just one of the examples where it enumerates the session. So if a management application comes in and calls netr session enum, the serve S server enumerates the session entries and basically calls out to the protocols saying, who has, you know, the first one, 12345? Who has the second one, you know, 23456? And it returns all those values to the netr session enum. So it's structured with ownership in the appropriate locations. And so the second structural thing, which I think I've mentioned before, but I just want to reiterate it here, is the importance of this document called MSFSA. FSA is the file system algorithms document, and it is possibly your most useful document for understanding the behavior of Windows file systems. This is the only behavior, well, this is actually NTFS behavior, but this is the behavior where you'll find everything that's truly useful in terms of the mysteries of Windows. This is just the introduction of FSA to reiterate what it's intended to do. It is there only to support SIFS, SMB, and SMB2. Right? That's its job in the corpus. Its relevance to SMB is actually multifaceted. Probably the most important is it defines the error codes. If I do X and it fails, what error comes back? You can read FSA and you can find out pretty much exactly every error code the file system returns and why. Algorithms, oplocks, and leases. This was a brilliant piece in this document. If you haven't read it, you should read it. It describes in very abstract but very easy to understand ways how oplocks and leases work, what the file system does, especially where it breaks them and what it breaks them to, right? There are several ways for an oplock to break. Locking and lock conflicts. Change notify, how does a change notify behave? What's the semantics of a change notify, especially as it walks down the tree? Wildcarding and file name matching, access checking, et cetera, et cetera. It's about 215 pages. It's a big chunk of work, but it's really, really, really useful. And how does SMB2, for instance, use FSA? A couple of different ways. One is inline, and we'll probably use more of this over time. Basically, in this routine where an object store indicates an opLock break, this is an upcall from the object store into the server saying somebody else opened the file, your opLock is breaking. And this basically says what is happening at this level, but you have to go look at FSA 315.73 to find out what's happening at the lower level. And here we just spell it out. We basically just say go look in there. In other cases where the behavior is more Windows specific, we take what's called a Windows behavior node approach. And for instance, here the server 3.3 is processing an SMB2 create. And so it's going to call create in the file system, but it has to map all these flags that came in the packet. You see all these bold flags that came in the packet? So here are the SMB2 parameters, and here are the object store parameters. This is basically a mapping from the wire to the file system. And so this is kind of your Rosetta Stone to help you decode the language of SMB2 down to the language of NTFS or NTFile create. And finally, next steps for the process. Continued refinements and changes from peer review, real-world testing in PlugFest, formal protocol testing, and new protocol features that might be coming. You know, we're still working on Windows, right? So you'll see all these things. The program doesn't end just because the regulatory oversight of the program ends, by the way. We're committed to this for a long time. And the feedback and participation is really key. Microsoft can't write it by ourselves, or if we do, you probably won't be totally thrilled with the result. It's an open process, right? It's called the open specifications because it's a two-way process. So I really encourage you to participate.
Thank you very much. Tom, are there any questions?
Cool.
All understood.
It's a process that I think everybody's familiar with, so I'm not hurt at all.
Oh, yeah. Chris.
Yeah, Tom was looking over here hoping I wouldn't open my mouth.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that was interesting and difficult during our part of our participation in this process was convincing people, both Microsoft and the TC, in fact, that the history that was inherent in this protocol was significant and that it was important to developers to have access to that connection. One way we did that was to demonstrate how many OS2 calls were still viable. How much of that history did they ask you to remove?
Chris, I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but a bunch of it. When it couldn't be replicated in Windows, a bunch of it. I'll give you an example. All those old Xenix error codes, I'm sorry, are no longer in there. The behavior must document Windows. It must be testable. And in particular, they weren't removed by the testing process. They were removed by the TC. And actually, the reason was that the table was incomplete, right? There's the NT status, and there's the SMB error code, right? And then there's the DOS error kind of thing. And there were holes in that table. And so the TC's request was, what's the NT status for this? And our answer was, Windows doesn't do it. There is no NT status. So they said it's inappropriate. And we were required by template to remove it. However, a good bit of the processing around the behavior is still there. A lot of those mays actually remained in there. Some of the legacy behaviors, like all the discussion of obsolescent versus deprecated calls, remains solidly in there. And I think that's actually the more useful part of it, because nobody really wants to interoperate with Xenix anymore. But I'm going to argue that. Maybe somebody else will argue differently. But, I mean, I don't know if there is a Xenix still booting. But the behaviors that were designed into the protocol are definitely still there. And Windows actually implements many of those deprecated commands.
Yep.
Sorry. Yeah, we still get bug reports against people running OS2 clients.
So oh, really?
Still,
okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's still a fairly, I won't say exactly vibrant, but there's a fairly active set of community out there.
Well, and, you know, to be honest, Windows probably interoperates against those same clients. And, you know, these things are out there and working. But our protocol documentation responsibility only goes back so far in time, right? Unless there were active developments for OS2 clients, you know, interested licensees who really needed this information, there's no regulatory reason for us to continue to publish it.
Just to be clear, the reason we put the Xenix codes in there was that they were the closest and only mappings we had to anything in the Unix world.
To the POSIX errors, yes,
right.
I know.
And that was the only reason we put them in there. But, you know, that information is available from the published documentation from OS2.
Right.
That is still available.
Right,
so.
Absolutely.
Any more questions?
Thanks.
Well, then, thank you very much for this informative talk. And I hope you do get some help. Now is our coffee break. It's for 15 minutes. I ask you...